Hello and welcome to the Beautiful Business Podcast, where today I am thrilled to be joined by Jamal Azel, founder of Change Please. This incredible social enterprise helps people who are experiencing homelessness to rebuild their lives. They help them with training to become a barista, giving them a home, giving them a job, and also some mental health support. Today, Jamal and I will dive into what it takes to run a business that's built for social impact. We'll talk about AI and how it will affect the future of businesses and the relationships that we build as a result of that, and how organizations can weave social good into their everyday work. I'm so excited to start. Let's get going. Welcome to the Beautiful Business Podcast from The Wow Company. If you're growing a UK business with a team of 8 to 80 people, you're in the right place. Every fortnight, we share honest conversations with brilliant business minds, exploring the realities of leadership, the challenges that come with growth, and ideas that make a real difference. From purpose to profit, people to process, this is your space for fresh thinking and down-to-earth inspiration. Jamal, welcome to the podcast. I am so excited to have you here today. Thank you so much for chatting with us.
Thanks for having me.
No worries. So we always start off by finding out a little bit more about you. And I'd love to know something about you that we wouldn't be able to find online.
I'm a recovering commodity broker. My parents were refugees, and I essentially had a bit of a breakdown, a midlife crisis at the age of 29. Maybe part of that story, which you can't find online, is that the reason I say a midlife crisis at the age of 29 was I had my palm read when I was like 16, 17. And they said that my life cycle finishes at 16. So effectively, 29 is effectively my midlife crisis.
Yeah,
rather
absolutely.
Than someone's hopefully third of their life crisis. I didn't want to leave this world with any regret and a feeling of being in this kind of rat race and this being in the matrix, essentially, where you're just working, and before you know it, you get to the age of 55, 60, and then you start to kind of switch off and enjoy your life. You know, it's how have you left the world in a better place? What have you done? What have you achieved? And I think those questions came to me. I was on a trip to Vietnam, just trying to discover kind of what my path of enlightenment should be. And it came on this kind of 18-hour bus journey where this American traveler sat on the bus. There was one space next to me, and he said, if you're not happy with your job or your life, you should do the rocking chair test. And that's to imagine sitting in your rocking chair at the age of 90, thinking about, yeah, how are your children going to remember you? Your grandchildren going to speak about when you're not here? Have you left the world in a better place? What's your legacy? You know, all these kind of deep, meaningful questions. And for me, it was obviously quite a difficult moment. And yeah, on that same trip in Vietnam, I stumbled across this silent tea house, where there was a tea house that was run by these ladies who nearly all were deaf. And they came together, created this beautiful space. And the only rule was that you had to be silent. You know, you had to order your tea with sign language. And it just blew me away. It was just so stunning. And then I realized, actually, you can do business and good at the same time. It didn't need to be this full-on charge or just making money. And, you know, you didn't have to be in one extreme charity, one extreme for profit. You know, you could find something in between. And that's where this idea, this concept of social enterprise came into my worldview, really. It was kind of, well, if we got this model of capitalism, then how about we try and use it for good, and we do capitalism for good, and we find a better way of using trade, not aid, to kind of transform people's lives. And that's effectively the model of Change Speaks. It's about selling a product that then you do good with the profits, or not just the profits, but then you do good with whilst generating the profits in the first place, which is what we do.
Wow, that's incredible. So did you actually go to Vietnam for that sort of enlightenment, or did it just happen by chance?
Yeah, so my partner, she did a whole gap year traveling, and I was joining her on different trips. So I perhaps took the trip slightly earlier than I was going to. And I went and met her while she was in Vietnam, not expecting anything really. That was now nearly, 12, 13 years ago. So it's been a very interesting journey since then.
Yeah. Yeah. And we will get into that for sure. I'm also fascinated by this idea of the silent tea room. It sounds like, oh my gosh, that sounds like a place that I would really get on board with, just to go and just be quiet and just sit and be. Sounds amazing.
I can't explain to you how busy it was, but then it was just silent. It was almost like going to a silent disco. And you know, so have you ever been to one and then you just take off the headphones and it's just silent? It's just like that the whole time, where, you know, all these people are just sitting, obeying the rules of the space, and it just made it such a peaceful space. And you could almost, without the external background noise and the street noise, but you could just imagine what it's like being in their mind, you know, just kind of this peacefulness. I said I want to do the same thing in London, in Clapham, and then I kind of realized I don't really like tea, I don't like Clapham, I don't like silence, like this is going to fail. The busier my life gets, the more I'm thinking actually a bit of silence might be quite useful, actually.
Yeah, well, another trip might be in order, eh?
Yes, exactly.
So for anyone that doesn't know about Change Please, can you just tell us what it's about? What do you do?
Yeah, so this problem of homelessness has been around for at least a century in the UK. And we found actually these old hobo symbols going back to the 1800s in the US. So it's been a massive issue and it's just got worse and worse. You know, in London, in the UK, you've got 350,000 people who are homeless, at least 125,000 children across the UK, across England, are homeless, according to the BBC. In New York, you've got 175,000 people. In, you know, all over the world, Paris, every major city, there's a huge issue. But the governments and NGOs are trying to tackle the problem through building housing. And they're not building housing quick enough. And even if they are building housing, it tends not to be social housing. You know, people will, you know, again, the capitalist system, maybe not for good, kicks in and then you end up getting unaffordable housing. So for us, it's looking at how do we tackle the problem of homelessness differently. And it's really around a job first model. It's if 44% of people who are homeless can work and want to work, then why not give that person an opportunity to lift themselves out of homelessness through work? The parts that are missing, training, so upskilling that individual and giving them the skills that they need, and then giving that person a living wage, and everything else knocks on from that point. The part we also do, which we find really works, is providing therapy and mental health services. That's really vital because we were giving somebody a job and a house, but it still wasn't working. That we needed to underpin that with mental health counseling. You know, the issue around homelessness is interwoven with mental health challenges, whether the person has been a victim of domestic abuse, sexual abuse, they've gone through a bereavement, a divorce, some sort of negative spiral, you know, they've been in the military, which you then have to unwind. And you can't just do that with a sticking plaster of a job at a home. You need to really unpick it. And that's why having in-house psychologists and counselors really makes a difference to us, because you can help understand the root trauma of that person and then help unlock the other things to then work. So effectively what we're doing is providing a training, a living wage job. And actually the living wage actually in November, we're expecting to go up to around £31,000 a year. So we're giving people a off the streets a ability to earn £31,000 in, which is, you know, it's not a considerable amount of money, but it is what you need to survive in London. And then a home, a bank account, therapy support, and then a new job typically after around 6 months. So what this model does is it gives that person a full wraparound support to sustainably come out of homelessness.
So you train them up, they go in, they do the work, and then you say they go out, do they go out after 6 months and find work outside of, you know, the like Change Please?
Yeah, we would find the work typically for them.
Okay.
And give them the opportunity to find the roles that what we've trained them up to do, whether that's in hospitality as a barista. We're now branching out to kind of look at other people to go into cleaning or security roles. So it really just gives that person onward employment opportunities. And what we're doing is we have a network of companies that buy our coffee, And then we combine that with the training to get that person ready to go potentially work in those clients' offices. So whether that's Google or Bank of America or a whole range of Goldman Sachs, a whole range of clients that both buy our coffee and then employ our staff at the same time.
That's incredible, isn't it? What a mission and what a success. And then when it comes to the living arrangements, is that kind of temporary with you and then you help them find more permanent, or does that you just find them a permanent place to start with? Like, how does that work?
Yeah, so effectively, if we're paying somebody a living wage of 31,000, in theory, they should be able to afford housing themselves. But on paper, the landlord still wants some sort of reference. They want a guarantee. They want first month's rent. They want a deposit. You know, all those things are still barriers that the individual will still struggle with. So what we then do is we say to the landlord, look, we're going to pay you the rent directly. So we're underwriting it. We will, when necessary, pay the person's first month's rent. We'll give the deposit. So we're unlocking all those barriers. And then we say to the landlord, we'll go back to the landlord and say, well, we've now got this person secured with you. In 6 months, we then see that that person then is able to sustain accommodation and employment, and then they're on the housing ladder, and then they can go and deliver it for themselves thereafter. So what we're doing is we're unlocking the initial barriers, getting them on that housing ladder, and then 6 months they're more independent. So we're tapping into the private renter sector as opposed to the social housing sector, which is completely snowed under with temporary accommodation. Councils are paying fortunes at the moment. So it's a very, very competitive market. So we're tapping into the private rental sector, and, you know, you can get accommodation at £31,000 a year income. So,
yeah, that's fascinating. Thank you for unpicking the whole model a little bit for us. So I'm really intrigued. You had this kind of epiphany, I guess, when you went to Vietnam of like, actually, I want to do something that is like not just for me, but, you know, leaves the world in a better place. So you've got this vision of like what that might look like for you. And was that what you created? Did you imagine that this was what you wanted to do, help people who are homeless, you know, and how you were going to do it? Was it how the vision started out for you?
I remember sending an email to my best friend and my spiritual guru at the time. On the 23rd of April 2013, as I left his tea house, and I went to the airport to leave that city. And effectively, I looked back on it a couple of years ago, and it was almost word for word what I'd written down is what we do now, without really any change to it. So I do feel that there's maybe something deeper where you kind of get given something to kind of go and deliver as your kind of like bit of your life mission, really. When I left Vietnam, I came back to London and saw a homeless person at Paddington and holding up a cardboard sign just with the words "change, please." And then a few weeks later, I went to an exhibition by Banksy, or not by Banksy, obviously he didn't put it on, but with an exhibition with Banksy's artwork. And he's done a street art with a homeless person sitting on the street with a coffee cup underneath them, and the sign above saying, "Keep your coins, I want change." And it was that sign that I needed, and that double pun, and that meaning I love puns. I was just like, right, this is the sign to go on this journey. I really believe that so many people have ideas and visions and have beautiful visions of the world that they want to, or different ways that they want to make the world a better place. I often look for alignment with the universe. It's going to sound a bit cosmic here, but I said to someone, I'd love to meet this person at a conference, and they just literally walk past that. I think it's the universe is telling you that either there's a glitch in the matrix, or keep going, you're on the right path. When things are difficult, you need that reassurance, and I think that's quite nice.
100%. Also, you seem to have like nailed manifestation, because by everything that you're saying, it's just happening for you, isn't it? The universe is really giving you this stuff.
It's great from a work sense. But I'm also an Arsenal fan. And then when I manifest something positive, it never happens. And when I manifest, like, oh, we're going to lose, like last night, we ended up winning. So I think there's either a positive manifestation or a negative, like, one as well. So I have to find that.
You can't have it all, Jamal, right?
I know, exactly. As an Arsenal fan. Maybe in a work sense, you can. Maybe,
yeah, exactly. Just not as an Arsenal fan. Yeah. So I'm really keen to, like, get into the nitty-gritty of that then, because I think you touched on a really important point there, that there are people out there that would absolutely love to make change in the world and work towards, you know, great stuff. But actually, when you've got the bills to pay and when you've got this pressure from just general society, like sometimes we're just swimming to survive, aren't we? So how do you balance this desire to help people, the world, leaving things in a better position than when you first started? How do you balance that desire with the actual practicalities of life and of running a business, right? Because running a business is brutal as well. So how do you balance those two things?
It is really tricky, because if you're a big green coffee brand or red coffee brand, you know, in the world, then they have one focus, which is sell, grow, give out dividends, etc. We need to sell coffee to then use all the profits to then help people. So effectively, you're running two different strands. You're running an impact strand and you're running a coffee commercial strand. So it is double the amount of work. But also, you get the rewarding piece and the satisfaction of doing that. There isn't this one thing of, you know, you just grown your business and what next, and you have no purpose. You're able to do a purpose whilst doing something which is satisfying at the same time. So I think one of the biggest challenges is when you're doing a social enterprise, there is that preconception. You're not able to deliver a high quality product whilst you're doing social good, because you can either do one or the other. And it isn't true. And, you know, so often we get people coming in and tasting our coffee and tasting, having a good experience and being surprised. And you shouldn't feel that way. You shouldn't feel surprised that actually it's good. You should feel like, expect that. And I really hope and believe that in the next 5 years, at least, we're going to see all businesses are social businesses and all businesses have weaved in impact into their everyday. But then you look at the government now pushing the Social Value Act, which is a commitment in social procurement to have a minimum 10% weighting in tenders in government contracts. And the knock-on effect of that is really powerful into other kind of tier one suppliers of government, etc. So we're then seeing social impact become a really core part of what organisations and government expect in the UK. The other countries that we're in are kind of catching up on that a little bit. But effectively, having the dual elements to the business and to our not-for-profit is much more difficult than just doing it, doing one or the other. And the public expecting or not expecting a kind of a surprise in the quality of the product, I think is also going to make a big difference as we start to see organizations shift a bit more towards social impact support.
Yeah, I love that. It makes me wonder though, because I guess that's what we've seen in the past, right? That actually when we get things from not-for-profit organizations, for example, when we buy things, actually the standard isn't always or hasn't always been up to what you might expect if you went and got something from a different line. But I don't know how I feel, like when you say that actually you want those expectations to be high, I totally understand that, because I'm like, actually, yeah, like we're proud, we're selling a good product here, like it's genuinely like good work that we're doing. So don't come in with less expectations. But also in my head, I'm like, well, when it's for good though, I as the consumer almost don't mind having slightly less high standards, because I know that what I'm doing is contributing to something. And as somebody who like would love to do good in the world, but doesn't feel like I have the means to be able to create that good in the same way as someone like yourself, I feel like actually like that's my little bit extra that I can give, is that I can drop standards and go, you know what, we're helping people here. So it doesn't matter if it's up to the best.
I had coffee vans with big signs saying sales weren't very good. We had a coffee van in like really great locations. I was like, oh my God, have I done the right thing here? I was telling us homeless trainees on the coffee vans that we had, look, I'm going to put up a big coffee brand, set a sign saying reducing homelessness one coffee at a time, and just be ready, because we're going to have hordes of people queuing up ready to come and support us. The misplaced trust in society that I had at the time to kind of like care was misplaced, and it just didn't work. I remember having some really fantastic locations, and it's brutal. It really, really is difficult. And we then got an agency probably about 3 or 4 years ago come in to give us some pro bono consulting support. And we put this question to them. We said, look, where is that balance of how will people go out of their way to compromise on further distance to travel to get to a place that's doing good, and or somewhere that perhaps might not be as good from a coffee quality perspective, but, you know, 10%, 20% less, but not, won't be as good an experience, but it's doing good for the world that we live in. And after extensive research, Chloe, genuinely, the number that came back was only 4% of people would.
Really?
And yeah, and, you know, it's, we're all so busy in the world that we live in. Big brands and companies are fighting for attention. Sustainability is a currency that they use in some instances to do that. We see a lot of greenwashing, a lot of whitewashing. A lot of people kind of like, you know, faking Mr. Beast kind of Instagram shorts, going in, giving someone who's homeless a kind of money and watching their reaction, all that kind of stuff. Well, we're just inundated by these short-term dopamine hits. We don't have the time to choose one and commit to one. If it's convenient for you and there's no compromise, then people will choose that and be connected to it. But only 4% of people, we believe, I used to think it was 5 and it's actually 4, but 4% of people will go out of their way to say, do you know what? I'm going to walk an extra 100 meters, an extra 200 meters. And if it's convenient for them and there's no compromise, then they will, and they become more sticky. But, you know, that realization that we've all sacrificed so much in our organization, and most charities and social businesses have, is it worth for 4% that compromise? Are we really going to change the world on 4% of people making a compromise? Or should we just say to ourselves, we don't expect anyone to come for a social mission, but we are going to be the best in class? You're flipping it around. You've then got a 96% of the audience that are coming to you.
Yeah.
And then you're then in a much better position to say, well, look, if you don't want to make a compromise because it's a social mission, then come and just have a non-compromised experience.
This is what I mean sometimes about business being brutal. Business doesn't care. Business itself doesn't care about social, does it, I guess? And speaking of business, so can we just talk about your growth here?
We have through about 370 concession sites and in partner locations across the UK. So that's in universities, in partner locations, in, we do the coffee in Downing Street, for example. And that's where Change Peace branded coffee bar, delivered by a third party. So delivered by a franchisee or a partner. Of our own locations, we've got 11 in London.
Okay, right. And then globally, where are you? How many countries are you in?
We're in 8 countries. We're also looking to, we've got a trademark ready for Tokyo and some partnerships with the government in Singapore. But yeah, we're the kind of main core markets that we are selling into is UK, France, Germany, Ireland, Australia, US. And then we also sell into another 15 markets in Europe as well. So yeah, it's a lot of international growth, and effectively it's where we've had so much opportunity in the work that we do, just looking at how we can launch into markets that have a high precedence rate of homelessness, but then also buy a lot of coffee.
So first of all, can we just take a minute? Because what an incredible, I mean, an incredible number just to pull out, like all of these successes in different countries. It's just, it's amazing. I mean, could you have imagined that when you had this epiphany and wrote down what you were looking for all those years ago?
If I know the challenges that would be faced in doing something, I would be put off, and I tend to just go do things out of blind trust. I was going to say stupidity there, but I held myself back. So blind trust. And believe that it can happen. And I need to feel that it's going to happen. I need to feel it's successful, because that's the part which rides me over the wave of when things get tricky and so on and so forth. That's the initial kind of like hope of it, and the excitement of it pushes me over all the inevitable issues that happen afterwards. So yeah, to answer your question, I mean, I was just so interested about the concept of homelessness. And when you go on the streets and you sit down next to somebody and just hear their story and then hear their kind of faith in themselves that they can still actually do something even though they've been through so much hardship, I just think it's such a waste in society to kind of give up on that person.
100%.
And say, because you have that label of homelessness, you're lazy, you might be a drug addict, you might have alcohol issues, or you might not, but we put those labels on you anyway, we're going to give up on you because it's easy to kind of forget about you because of those labels. But they haven't forgiven, they haven't forgotten them about themselves. They haven't given up on themselves, sorry. And I think if we can jump over that disconnect of those lazy media stereotypes, and see the person how they want to be seen and give them a bit of hope, I think that's the part which it makes it inevitable to say, you know, that we have to tackle this problem in a different way. It can't just be status quo.
Do you have a high success rate of supporting them, or do you find that there are some people that you look to support that maybe don't have as much faith in themselves and struggle to go through the program that you offer them?
You know, being out on the streets and seeing thousands of people walking past you on a daily basis does break you down, understandably. Whenever I hear our trainees speak at the graduations, it just shocks me how much no one speaks about the thing that's changed their life is the job and the house. But the thing that changes their life is the faith that we've given them, the acceptance of colleagues and the team to welcome them into our family, the pattern of turning up in the mornings, the structure, and rebuilding confidence and self-belief and self-worth. And all of that is so much more powerful to the people that we support than we've given you a job. And all the stuff that we think is going to be useful to that individual is tertiary. It's more about having that purpose, having that confidence, that faith, that dignity. And that's the part which, going back 10 years, I would never have guessed. I was just thinking, let's give somebody a job. And then I was like, okay, let's give somebody a house. And actually, still not working, let's give somebody therapy and trauma support. And that's the part I thought was going to be the kind of the secret sauce. But it's actually really about the making somebody feel human and connected. During COVID, governments around the world put people who were homeless into hotels. And we were kind of shocked that it worked. People stopped on paper becoming homeless. But as soon as COVID finished, people went back to the streets. And even that hotel scheme struggled to kind of like survive in those moments, because effectively you were changing the label on paper of homelessness by putting somebody into accommodation where they weren't out on the streets, they weren't homeless. However, and Harvard University did a study on this, the thing that really makes a difference to someone who's homeless is changing the connectedness, the social connectedness of that individual, away from putting someone in a room and they're still lonely, they still have the trauma, they still have the pain, they're always dependent on somebody else, they don't have a purpose, and they're not feeling part of society, but they're not homeless anymore. Whereas the work that we do is really around, you know, giving a person that, as I said before, the kind of the connectedness, the social, you're not lonely, you're part of a team, et cetera, et cetera. And that's the part that works. And Harvard University's work, I think Stanford, if you type in an article by Stanford University by a guy called Simon Dwight, Professor Simon Dwight, he mentioned Change Please as a kind of exemplar in the space about how to really tackle homelessness. And he cites this as a real, the long sustainable way of tackling homelessness isn't just by giving people accommodation and work and homes, but it's about purpose and jobs and employment, I think.
That just makes such sense though, doesn't it? Like, even whether you're homeless or whether you're not homeless, like if we only revolved our entire life around our home and our work, like our purpose is, for some people that might be enough of a drive, but I think for a lot of people there would be a real struggle about actually what am I here for? Like, I don't understand what else. So actually it makes total sense that if you were to just pull someone off the street and give them a home and a job, that's one thing, but we're human, we need that connection, don't we?
I genuinely believe in the next kind of 4 or 5 years we are going to be thinking about a post-work world where we won't have so many jobs are going to be displaced out of due to AI. And I think we see it as a bad thing, looking at kind of capitalist economic models where we are conditioned to think that work is the main way, the only way for you to have purpose. But when AI takes our jobs, we are going to have to think about how do we find purpose in a different way. You know, I don't think universal basic income is going to work. Government's going to have to think of something else. The majority of the money is going to be in the main US top eight companies who own all the GPUs and the chips. And it gives us as humans, for the first time in, I think, 150-200 years, the opportunity to think about, why do we wake up in the morning? What is the real way of having purpose and social connection? And how do we spend more time with our family, more time with friends and people we love? And I think COVID was a bit of an experiment of that, you know, not working, but then exploring the world a bit more, moving out of central London to the donut, to the kind of outer skirts. And I think we will get that social connection naturally, as opposed to it being from a working world, if that makes sense, which is still both are fine. But I just think AI is going to take us down in a different format to experience that slightly differently. And I think there's a dystopia to that, which sounds bad, losing jobs, et cetera. But I think it's inevitable that we're going to have to find different ways of having, and we're going to experience social connections and family much more than we are at the moment. And I think it's going to be a better way of life. It's just, how do you have that disconnect between the majority of the money and the tax income coming in West Coast, US, when the rest of the world don't have their own GPUs and they're sovereign AI?
I wonder though, how does that affect everything that you're doing? If you can imagine a world, which, by the way, you're the second person just on this podcast that said to me that you think the other person was an AI expert. So, you know, there's definitely a pattern forming here where you think actually the world of work is going to significantly change and we're going to have to find purpose elsewhere. I can't imagine that, because I just can't imagine a world in which the government will let us do that and not contribute to society in the way that we do currently. But how would that affect what you do then, Jamal? Because a huge part of what you do is you of course bring that connection, and you bring, but again, that connection comes through, you know, the training and the relationships that they build within the workplace and how they then move into society in that way. So have you thought about what that would do for your model?
Yeah, we're just about to launch a new AI platform that's funded by the Cabinet Office for a trial for 5,000 people in Southwark, with Southwark Council, with the Centre for Homelessness Impact. And the government feel, or Centre for Homelessness Impact feel, that the solution that we're launching is going to be a very powerful way to prevent people from becoming homeless in the first place. I think it's still going to take governments and social revolution a further 3 to 4 years to find solutions for it. So not the next government cycle, but the one after that, in my mind, will be one that will be about how about this point around purpose, around jobs, about a new economic model, about so much of the taxable income that the government needs us to work from the time we're children to going through this kind of like regurgitation of knowledge through the education system and having a kid, having classrooms of 30 kids and knowledge and getting kids up to certain standards and blah, 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 has all been for society to get us to contribute to GDP so that we've got taxable income to then grow and survive and so on and so forth, right? That's how we've developed in the last 150 years. So to then change that to finding a different source of income or a different revenue stream to pay for social welfare, or not universal basic income, because I think it just causes deflation and it's good on small pilots and small, but it doesn't work as a country as a whole. But finding that different economic model is going to be the challenge of not the next government, the government after. And in between, I really believe there's going to be a social revolution. And I think the way that that's going to work is creating a model where we have a different economic system, a different currency, which is based on how we do services or work for other people, but not through the current fiat systems. I think there's going to be a lot of change. Change, please. What's so exciting about the work that we do is that we're incredibly entrepreneurial, we're disruptive, we're at the forefront of lots of changes where we've done change fees 10 years ago, we've done buses, we've done AI, we've got really incredible well-being healthcare solutions. Loads of these things are super exciting to be able to adapt. And I think there's going to be, at least for the next 8 to 10 years, elements of social inequality. And our model works through trying to find guidance and purpose for that social inequality. So that's how we're going to adapt. The answer might not be workforce development or employment, but I think being on the forefront of how do we create a reciprocated model where we don't pay people to do a service, which robots and AI can do. You know, if you can pay £3,000 in China with companies like Unity to get a state-of-the-art humanoid, you can do that today. $3,000, sorry. We honestly, in 4 or 5 years, so many jobs are going to go towards AI and robots. So we are going to need to find a new way of having a income stream where people are have a working model, but then we at the same time deliver a service for other people. So, I mean, that's for people smarter than me, but I'm sure in the next 4 or 5 years, I want us to be at that kind of forefront of innovating and finding a solution to tackle that problem, because it will definitely happen. I said we were in Baltimore last year doing an event with some of my colleagues, and I said, genuinely, I believe there's going to be AI politicians on our doorstep soon. I mean, and a year ago, some of the politicians that we had in government and the lies and all this kind of stuff, and you know, you see the amount of corruption that happens around the world in politics. I'd much prefer to vote for an AI politician, AI minister, who I know will deliver the manifesto that they set out, rather than politics and corruption and that kind of stuff. And my colleagues were saying, absolutely no way. If you type into Google, 2 weeks ago, the Albanian government just launched a new AI minister, which is effectively, there's so much corruption apparently in Albania that they launched an AI minister, which they know, or will at least, and even if they reduce corruption by 20%, and it's still not as perfect as it, or it's not 100% reduction in corruption, it's still 80% better than it is now. So I think that's the world that we're going to be moving into. And I'm excited by the change and adapting and finding answers for it.
Okay. So bringing it back then to the now, and to the team that you work with. So I'm really intrigued by how you build, or how you and the team that you have continue to build a culture where you are able to empower others and help them develop themselves for their own career. But also on top of that, with your particular brand and your particular sector, I guess, is also thinking about like the dignity of others when they're at their most vulnerable, and like being able to support essentially what businesses would call their clients, but actually for you, the people that you work with, I guess, feels like a nicer way to say it, you know, how you support them in a really human way as well. So how do you build that culture, and how do you recruit for that sort of thing?
Firstly, our financial model isn't reliant on government contracts or philanthropy where you have to just push for a certain outcome or target. We sell a product, and our clients trust us to have an end outcome, and we deliver the impact in a way that we feel is the best for society. So by giving somebody therefore that allows us to be more holistic in the people that we support. And one person will have completely different needs to the next person, and we are looking at that individual as opposed to the model, them fitting the model, we fit the model to them. So what if you work backwards from that point, the authenticity, the sincerity, the integrity that we have means that when people join our team from phenomenal companies and the open market, and they join our company, people are seeing that we are doing things from heart and not doing things because we are trying to make numbers work, if that makes sense. So that feeds into everything that makes people, from a cultural perspective, want to come to work. It makes them want to feel part of this mission, this movement. They see the authenticity in how we're helping people and how genuine it is. And that really feeds into everything else. It makes them want to do work for the right reason. It makes, they realize that, you know, we don't pay dividends out. There's no profit going to somebody else. So therefore, they are investing themselves into making this work, as opposed to, right, this guy's this month, we've got a target of, you know, 150 people, 200 people, 300 people. What have you done? What's your numbers? You know, why haven't you turned up at 8 o'clock in the morning? We don't have that culture. We're just looking at the outcomes. And we come together to try to find what is the best way as a team to deliver those outcomes, as opposed to kind of forcing people to hit metrics. And I think that change in culture about a human-centric approach is far more powerful to align people to our purpose than having people feel that we're just a kind of conveyor belt, a factory of impact, if that makes sense. Which I have seen quite a lot of social enterprises and charities trying to hit targets to kind of keep, and they're doing it because the world's difficult financially. They need to hit, they've got contracts to deliver, and it just makes it slightly more challenging to do that unless you go and hit those numbers, really.
And I guess that's what comes up for me here, right? So you are a not-for-profit organization, but you still need profit to be able to work, right? So I guess in my head, I'm thinking it, like, that just sounds like an absolute dream to have a workforce of people who you can go, look, this is the outcome that we're looking for. I don't care how we get there. We just need to give everything that we can to get this outcome. But then equally, how does that then balance with the profit that you need to keep the business going and to keep growing and being able to help support more and more and more people?
Externally, I've been using the word profit quite a lot, but internally we say surplus. So effectively, when we're making that surplus, we're giving that to our foundation to deliver impact, whether that's on our buses, whether that's on our barista training program. It's a whole range of our services that we deliver. So that surplus is the extra that we've made as margin from the sale of our products, or from actually potentially from philanthropy. We almost see it as two separate entities within the work that we do. One's a go out, win surplus, and the other one is about spending it and doing good. And that's how we make it a bit easier for people to kind of get their heads around these two distinct areas, really. So I think the language is really important for that.
You've also worked with some massive brands, and I just wonder, again, from a business perspective, strategically, how do you approach this? Is it, again, carrying that same message through of what your outcome is and, you know, come along for the ride? Or is there a bit more of a, we really want to work with you, so how can we make this work?
I think less about the brands, but I think more about the humans that are in those companies. You could speak to two different people within the same organization and they'll one would want to work with us and one might be 50-50 or not want to work with us. What we try to do is really connect with individuals and show individuals the work that we do. Don't be disheartened when organizations will say no, but I think what we try to really do is before we speak to an organization or a partner, potential partner, we find the real alignment with that organization. So for example, Nespresso is a phenomenal example and they've really supported us to grow. They do genuinely hand on heart, and I'm not just saying this because we work with them. I'm not sponsored by them or anything, but I went out to Origin to see the farms that they work with, and it just genuinely blew me away. I've been in the coffee industry for kind of 10 years, and I know it just annoys me so much how I think more so in the UK, I don't see this in the US, there's a saying where effectively when someone gets big enough, we in the UK kind of like cut them at the root, because and you kind of want to bring them down a peg. And it's difficult to talk about brands or companies doing good if they become big, because people either expect them to do so or they think that's greenwashing. Whereas I just see that huge organizations have really phenomenal people working for them, and they want to have a purpose. They want to do good. And going to Origin with Nespresso and seeing the farms and the farmers and the work that they do, like supporting farmers kind of 5 years in the future, genuinely blew me away. And for them, you know, we really found an alignment between both organizations where they do so much great work at Origin and we do so much great work on local streets that kind of synergy just worked so well for both parties, and the relationships has been absolutely fantastic. So I think to answer your question, we really try to find synergy in partnerships. We try to make sure that it's natural, it works. 40% of people who are homeless who complain about pain in their mouth, and 15% have tried to pull out their teeth out of sheer pain. So partnering with a brand like Colgate to provide dental services for rough sleepers on the streets, where your oral hygiene connects into your cardiovascular and your cognitive well-being, it's just a no-brainer. Like, why aren't we doing that? And then you speak to brands and say, look, this is our vision. And again, you find the humans in that organization that want to make the change, not just for the brand. The brand part should be obvious before we even speak to that organization. But it's finding the human in that organization which aligns with that vision. And that's I think how we've done so well in those brand partnerships. It's feeling like there's a natural fit before we even speak to somebody or they speak to us. Otherwise, it just won't, there won't be legs in it longer term.
And this might be a silly question, but when you say you need to find the right person, have you got, is there some sort of pattern around who that is for you guys? Like, is it generally the CEO or is there someone else? Is there a typical person that you look for to find that connection?
When you speak to the CEO or someone a super senior, you get people looking actually at this as an individual. And them trying to do good and leave a legacy. And it's a bit more, it's a bit bigger than what the company's thinking. When you speak to people in particular positions, they are rightly looking at how doing this is good for their own function. So obviously, if you speak to somebody in a sales team, knowing that they can sell our product, they're going to think about, okay, this is going to make me hit my targets and sell more. If you speak to marketing, they think about it from a PR perspective. If you speak to somebody in HR, they're going to think, okay, well, maybe this diversifies our workforce where we can have more people from minority groups. So everyone looks at it from their lens, but the more senior you get, you do get people thinking about this as a kind of like the right thing to do. It's a legacy. It's not just about my individual function. It's about how can we have more halo purpose. So I think that's the difference. You just have to change your narrative to match the person you're speaking to, I would say.
Makes total sense. And I guess the other thing that I'm really interested in as well is it feels like, I guess nowadays, that there are only so many ways. Well, it feels like it can be really broad, but in some ways within business, it feels like there are only so many ways to make a good social impact. So, you know, if you're either a not-for-profit or you're B Corp certified or whatever that looks like. But I'm just wondering if you've got any practical advice for any business owner, CEO, anyone who can create that social impact within their business without having to change their entire model. Do you have any advice for someone that might be wanting to do that?
I think the impact piece is what gives us the uniqueness. That purpose at the core of what we do, the why, is why people buy into us. And I don't see it as an either or situation. I think you can, as a small business, just think about actually doing the good part is maybe might help you sell more and do more. It isn't just a case about doing good. So if you can't afford to do it from an altruistic perspective, think about it from a commercial perspective. I genuinely believe in the next 5, 6, 7 years that it's going to be a basic requirement for organizations to have to be doing good anyway and not just be doing a transactional service for people. So if you're weaving that into the work that you do now, it's going to make a massive difference to, I think, your commercial outcomes at a later stage. So it doesn't have to be one or the other. And it can start as simple as, you know, we are training people day in, day out who are good. Contact us and see if any of our trainees could potentially work within your organization. Speak to amazing groups like Crisis, Centerpoint, Thames Reach, or organizations that support people who have got some kind of learning difficulties, you know, and just see if there's any part of the work that you do that can employ people who are doing good. Or can you become a B Corp yourself? You used a B Corp example. I think it's a phenomenal organization. So I think there's so many different ways of doing good. As long as, even if you're doing something tiny, but it's done with authenticity and integrity and you do it sincerely, I think people will feel that and you'll get a return. Believe me, I think, you know, what I was mentioning before about being in a flow with somebody, so doing the right thing and manifesting that. I don't think that's the reason that's happened to me is not about manifesting and it happening. I really believe it's you're doing the right thing and the universe, you're being on the same level as the universe, if that makes sense. You're in that flow moment, and as a consequence, if you're even doing a small percentage of some element of good, it's getting closer to your flow. And I promise you, I feel in my heart that you do that good and good things will happen. So don't think about the immediate short term. Think about what's the bigger picture and what's the right thing to do for the world that we live in.
100%. I love that advice. Thank you. I'm just wondering as well. So you're in a position now where you're established, you're doing good, which is wonderful. And, you know, you've got this incredible social enterprise. What about diversification within what you do? Because a lot of your stuff is around like the coffee element, right? But have you got any other side hustles that you work with? And if you have, then how do you decide, actually, I'm going to tap into this, but still keep aligned with the mission that I've already got?
The examples of the buses where we launched these four buses that are sponsored by amazing brands, or were sponsored by amazing brands like Colgate, HSBC, now David Lloyd. And we're speaking to many more organizations at the moment. And they deliver our purpose, but we get financial revenue from brands sponsoring the buses themselves. And then the AI solution. So we're doing something that the government feels is going to make a difference to preventing people from becoming homeless. We then will be able to sell that to councils and to government separately. And so it's using capitalism for good, essentially.
Amazing. Before we wrap up properly, I feel like we would be doing a disservice to anyone that's listening if we didn't just talk a little bit about homelessness itself, and just to raise a bit of awareness around it, right? Because I think we can quite quickly fall into the trap of what we picture homelessness to be, and you know, where we see it and what it looks like and what it means. So some of these might be really basic questions for you, but I'd love for you to just help us to really get that full picture. So the first sort of, I guess it's a quick fire question. The first quick fire question that I've got for you is, can you share a stat or a fact about homelessness that might be a surprise or might be new information to someone who's listening to this?
You know, if you've got 350,000 people who are homeless in the UK, 44% want to work and can work, but you also have high demand for hospitality jobs, cleaning jobs, etc. You know, we're at that intersection of both. So it's really changing the labels and the mentality of people who are homeless, not being lazy, not faking it, but wanting to kind of contribute back to society and re-enter society. That's the key part for me. It's that 44% of people who are homeless want to work and can work.
And again, this might seem like a really strange question, so if I need to explain more than I can, but what does homelessness actually look like?
It's different based on the different part of the spectrum of homelessness that you're in. On one end of the spectrum, it could just be you've gone to work and be told that you're going to be made redundant and you've only got £300 in your bank account and that's not going to cover your next month's rent. It's going down to the shops and seeing your landlord in the corridor, and the landlord says, by the way, I'm going to have to put your rent up, and or I'm going to have to serve you a Section 21 notice. Being a 16-year-old kids being told by their parents who've got mental health issues, actually, you've got to leave the house tomorrow because, you know, and they can't cope and blah, 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 and you know where to go. To then sleeping on someone's sofa, to women who are on staying in relationships or in accommodation with abusive relationships because they are too scared of leaving in case they end up on the streets, where there's an even higher rate of sexual violence and you're being forced and trapped to stay in that environment. To the other extreme, which is the face that we see of homelessness, of that kind of disheveled person sitting out on the street, who's been out there for 2, 3, 4, 8 years, who slightly more institutionalized, you know, that there is a full spectrum of people. And the frustrating piece is people seeing everyone who's homeless or labeled as homeless as that kind of final piece of that disheveled person that I mentioned. And my favorite film is The Bronx Tale, which is, there's a line in there where Sonny says, the saddest thing in life is wasted talent. We have an opportunity to get people into work, and because of lazy labels and stereotypes, and seeing people all in the same bucket, it's very easy to forget the ability of that person to contribute when we need them to be.
And then if you live somewhere in the UK that maybe doesn't see a lot of homelessness in any stretch, actually, maybe you don't know someone that might be in a tricky situation, maybe you don't see that disheveled person sat outside of a train station, you know, how can those people who don't see that on a day-to-day basis contribute to helping somebody?
Yeah, I mean the obvious answer is buy Change Peace Coffee. But there's so many phenomenal social enterprises in every country. There's so many amazing charities that are doing good. I think where you do see that person out on the streets or in need, you put aside those stereotypes and your preconceptions, and you think about how that person can contribute, But I would, at the very least, just making eye contact with somebody and smiling. I can't tell you how much that helps someone. You don't need to give somebody money. You don't need to kind of go into this full exchange with an individual and sit there and go and get them a sandwich and something to eat and all that kind of stuff. Something as simple as just making eye contact and smiling and making them feel that they're still connected. I think all of that is just so powerful to make a difference to somebody's life, really. And that's a really good starting point. But there are some things that we're going to be launching next year, which will be make it easier for people to kind of give and support. I can't tell you what it is, but it's really exciting. But it's using technology to kind of interact more with people who are homeless and understand the situation and contribute more. And I think going back to one of your previous questions is, you know, how are we going to adapt? And for us, it's really about technology and how we can do that.
Okay, so watch the space then to see what's coming up for how we can contribute. And the last thing then are, what are some of the things that we don't think about when it comes to homelessness? Like something you mentioned earlier about like dental work and how much pain someone might be in just through, you know, poor dental hygiene. So what else aren't we thinking about when it comes to homelessness, do you think?
I think those social bonds, I think it's vital to feel, make people feel connected, because if 17% of all the deaths last year from homelessness or from suicide, you never know how that one connection with that individual can make them go into a different direction. Changing those labels and those self-perceptions of individual, I think, is absolutely vital. But, you know, combining it with one of your other questions, you know, really looking at how, by giving people a chance to re-enter society, we can think about how we can integrate them back into our own workforce. You know, even if it's doing an internship or doing a work placement or at Change Please, for example, we often pay for people out of our own cost to go into employer sites and do a day or 2 days of work experience for free. And just to kind of like, you know, do a role or to kind of get some experience. And I think that makes a massive difference to people as well. So I think it's really, how do we integrate individuals into the working world and think about how we can ourselves adapt the work that we do to kind of combine people in more kind of socially challenged situations.
I love that. I think that's really going to help to broaden the perspective on it. I think a lot of people can just jump straight to one vision of what someone experiencing homelessness might look like, act like, be like. So that's really helpful. Thank you. Just to wrap up then, we ask everyone this question and I can't wait to hear your answer. What does beautiful business mean to you?
I think beautiful business is using capitalism as a Trojan horse. Effectively, we've got this system of capitalism that has worked for the last 100-150 years. It might have got a little bit out of control with the 1%, and especially now, I don't even know if it's the 1%. I think what's happening in Silicon Valley, it's the 0.001% that have, you know, majority of the wealth. So how can we be better exemplars of what that business future looks like and the business for good looks like? And that partly motivates me. It isn't just about the work we're doing helping people who are homeless, but what we're doing to kind of show that there's a different way to this capitalist system. And that for me is really what's beautiful, to kind of be able to shine a light on something that is working and has been successful and use it as a representation for other people just to copy and do the same thing. That's what excites me and makes me feel beautiful inside, perhaps.
Oh, what an incredible answer. What a way to finish. Thank you so much for joining me on the podcast, Jamal. I've really, really enjoyed this conversation and I feel like I've learned loads. So thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Sorry about all the AI chat and boring.
Don't be. Everyone talks about it. I think it's really important. So thank you.
Thanks, Larry.
Thank you for listening to the Beautiful Business Podcast. If you've enjoyed this episode, then please remember to subscribe and leave us a review. For more advice and practical tips on what it's really like to build a beautiful business, visit our content hub at wowco.uk/hub or check out the link in the show notes.